Welcome to Everything Belongs, a podcast for those living, creating, leading, and thriving while in the deep end of life. I'm your host, Madison Morgan, leadership coach, creative consultant, and speaker. I coach soulful visionaries and go-getting mavericks who desire to create art of their lives and take their work both deeper and higher. In this show, I'll be bringing you an overflow of conversations with my favorite thought leaders, teachers, healers, and creatives who inspire me to live more fully in my own power, worth, and wholeness, along with offering some episodes where I share my own practical insights, behind-the-scenes peeks into my process, and tools I use on my own journey. There will not be much we shy away from here because at this table, everything belongs. Therefore, you can expect me to ask the uncomfortable, juicy questions. You can expect that you'll hear people you disagree with on the podcast and maybe even ideas you've never previously considered. I trust you with your own discernment as we take this deep dive. You can expect to laugh, cry, learn, and be challenged by the guests as they share their diverse experiences and views of the world. It's my hope through learning to see that all of it belongs that you will develop a more sovereign way of holding yourself so you can playfully go after the life, relationships, and career you are made for, to let all parts of yourself have a seat at the table, to lead and create from your deepest truth and become your own source of validation, all because you finally know you're worthy of it. All that's required to get started, that you show up curious and willing. Let's dive in. What's up, everybody? I'm super thrilled because today is our 100th episode of Everything Belongs, which means I'm doing a special Q&A Ask Me Anything episode. And gratefully, whenever I sent these questions, the opportunity to ask questions out to Instagram and to my email list, there were an abundance of questions, so much so that I'm breaking the episode up into two parts. So this week, I'm going to be answering personal life questions, relational questions, some fun questions. And then in part two, next week, I'm going to be answering a bunch of business questions about how I run my business, growing my business over the last 8 years. And yeah, I'm really excited for this. And what feels really good is if you've been listening to the show, you know that I'm going to be headed into a podcast break. We have some really fun ideas planned for, well, some things we're working on behind the scenes, my team and I. And I want to devote all of my time and energy to that this fall, so that we can record some really good episodes for you to air in the winter of 2023 or summer if you are in the Southern Hemisphere. So in the beginning of 2023, we'll be coming back with more podcast episodes. We're not going away forever, but I do want to take a little break to make sure this other project I'm working on gets all of the love and attention it really deserves and that I'm not half-assing any podcast episodes due to lack of time or energy. So I'm really excited to close what I'm calling the first very long season, 100 episodes of Everything Belongs, with some Q&A for you. And then we'll be back in 2023 with some really fun content, some more micro doses, some more interviews, and hopefully a really beautiful project that we'll be launching before then. So before we dive into the show today, all the Q&A, I want to remind you that next week on September 14th, I do have a free donation-based workshop for business owners. It's called Vision Cast. And in the workshop, it's 60 minutes, an hour long, I'm going to be sharing practical business spells that will help you show up, serve it up, and be seen. This one-hour workshop is for heart-led visionaries who want to give, make, and serve more. So give more in their work, make more money, and really serve more with what they're sharing. I specifically created this because whenever I started in my business 8 years ago, I didn't hire a business coach or invest in any business content for a couple years into my business. And by the time I did, I was super out of alignment with the way I wanted to be doing my work. I was overgiving. I had lack of boundaries. I was self-extracting. I had far too many ideas and lack of clarity and some perfectionism, lack of systems was showing up in my work, and I really needed to hire people, and I didn't know how. And I was super struggling with fear of projections, fear of what people thought, not being understood and not being seen, and that proving energy was really showing up in my work. And so I'm going to be sharing how I learned how to alchemize all of those energies by talking about living into the light side of the surface heart archetype, the visionary archetype, and the artist archetype. We'll talk about if you are a new business owner or if you have been in business for a while, how to identify where you actually need support and systems versus where you need skill and capacity as a CEO, because these are different needs and they require different support, different education. So if you need business support and business systems, you might hire someone who teaches those things versus if you need skill and capacity as a CEO, you might hire a coach or a therapist to help you build that capacity. And then we'll talk about living into what I call sovereign leadership through integrity, capacity, equity, regeneration, service, and self-expression. We'll be doing a live practice to orient you to the entity of your business, which is a spiritual way that I like to connect to my business as a spiritual practice. So if you are curious about any of my business consulting instead of my longer 90-day program, Serve It Up, this is a free or donation-based opportunity to connect with me in that way and get a lot of content going in your business that feels good. So again, it is on September 14th. It's at 11 a.m. Central Time, but if you sign up, you can get the recording, which is available for a week. So go ahead to madisonmorgan.com/visioncast, or if you are in the podcast app, you can just click the show notes and it'll take you right there. Well, without further ado, let's dive into this Q&A episode. I want to start us off with some of the four fun questions, because I think there's actually a lot of really deep questions people sent in, and the fun ones just, I think it's a nice place to start. So this person asks, what do you look for in adult friendships? And this is actually something I did in a full inventory at our winter ceremony. We do a ceremony every year whenever we're launching Rising Sovereign, and I really teach how to build a support system that centers like your own sacredness. And these are some of the things that I wrote out whenever I was building my own inner sanctuary. So self-responsibility is like a number one for me. People who enjoy their own company, people who have the capacity for celebration. I realized that in my life, due to the way I was parented and a parent with mental illness, I really struggled feeling seen and celebrated. I have always been a sparkly person, and I've realized that if anyone feels jealous or some weird stuff around celebration and joy, it's difficult to be close to them because the diminishment in those relationships becomes too much. So capacity for celebration, not just of me, of course, but of themselves. Like they can really celebrate themselves. They can celebrate other people. They can celebrate holidays. All of that's really important to me. It's important to me that my adult friends do not talk shit on their bodies or anyone else's body. I feel very grateful that my inner circle, we don't talk about our bodies in that way. And if someone has like a moment, it's just really like, whoa, we don't do that here. And I'm very grateful for that. And I want someone in my life who is like supportive and honest, but also will, you know, call me out on my bullshit, and not in the like call you out way where they're like, I noticed something bad about you. But if I'm doing the same old thing, they're like, hey, you're doing the thing you always do. I want adult friends who can resolve conflict and anger with maturity. People who can be with their shame, jealousy, and pain in a way that honors the dignity of others. I just look for resonance, like people who just feel resonant. Sometimes the energy is just right with people. And then I love people who have like really interesting special interests. Like a lot of my friends are like nerdy in a way that I really love. Even if I'm not interested in the same thing, people who are passionate about what they do in a really like deep way, I just love that. I love listening to people talk about the thing that they love the most. So that's what I look for in adult friendships. This next person asks, do I snore? And I have never been told that I snore. Yeah, I don't think so. But I guess, how could I know for sure? I do have the Oura Ring that tracks my heart rate variability, and it tracks my sleep, and it tracks my oxygen in the night. And I usually have a really great optimal oxygen score at night, which would be an indicator that I probably don't snore. If you're ever sleeping in the same house as me, you're probably not going to know I'm even there. So, have I ever regretted the way I treat another woman? And yes, I've regretted the way I've treated a lot of people. Especially dating women, you know, like people who I've dated, I've showed up as my worst self around. People that I've been like dear friends, I've shown up as my worst self around. I wouldn't say I've ever like bullied anyone or been intentionally unkind or gone out of my way to be mean to anyone. But I look back and I'm like, ooh, I would do that differently. You know, I think that maybe we all share that. I certainly feel that way when I look back at my younger years, especially being in evangelicalism and just perpetuating the same beliefs that I had. Like, I look back and I'm like, I wish I hadn't done that. Like, I gave my younger sister a purity ring. And even though I wasn't like intentionally trying to harm her, not that she accepted it anyway, but I wish I hadn't have done that, you know? So I don't know if that's under the category of like the way I treated someone, but I certainly perpetuated the same shit that was done to me. So do I ever eat shitty foods like hot dogs? I love a hot dog. Of course, I'm not like eating hot dogs all the time, but like in the summer, I love a hot dog. But honestly, I prefer a bratwurst. Like if I can get a bratwurst with some really good mustard and some sauerkraut, oh my God, my mouth is watering now. Like I love that so much. I will say, as far as like shitty foods, I try not to subscribe to the idea of like bad foods, good foods, but I'm a very sensitive body and my food, like I don't have any food allergies anymore. Actually, after I left my ex-husband, all my food allergies went away, which is so wild. I was like lactose intolerant. I was having so many issues with food before. All had to do with chronic stress, actually. So I can eat all foods. I don't have any restrictions in my diet. I eat meat, I eat dairy, I eat gluten, I eat sugar. Like I eat all of those things, but I am very sensitive. So like I live my life mostly sober from alcohol. I will have a drink every now and then, but I don't love how it makes me feel. And I don't necessarily crave sweet foods. That's not my craving. Mine's usually like salty, sour foods. So like pickles, like I love some pickles. But if I'm driving, like I drove across the country recently and I just was craving a cheese quesadilla from Taco Bell, which that is like the thing I've gotten since I was a child. I don't eat anything else from there. It's always a cheese quesadilla. And so if I'm eating fast food, that's what I will get. I will admit, like I don't eat like McDonald's hamburgers or anything. I've actually only had a fast food hamburger once. I just don't like it. So I probably only have like those sorts of foods once a quarter or so, but I eat them with no shame and absolute delight. And if like someone around me is like, let's get takeout, let's get a pizza, I'm like, yes. Like I love a pizza. Emo's is my favorite pizza. I'm a St. Louis person. So next question is, what am I curious about right now? I am currently, gosh, just such in a deep dive around women with autism, particularly women with autism who are late in life diagnosed, people in leadership who have autism, and people like how that's very overlooked in those assigned female at birth. I am very curious about staying connected on the internet with less self-extraction from my personal life. I have not felt well with the amount of projection and constant overgiving on the internet. Even like in my pullback from that, I still share so much and it doesn't feel good anymore. So I'm really looking at that as I give a podcast Q&A, but this does feel good. Like I'm just playing with formats of like, how can I stay connected and share without self-extracting and keep my business abundant. I'm very curious about some shamanic studies. I'm doing a year-long program with an amazing shaman named Karen who lives in my area. She's like an elder witch. She's absolutely incredible. And I actually just purchased a home. And so I'm not in it yet. I won't even be in it when this podcast airs because it's like getting a new roof and all of those things. But I'm really excited about it. And so I'm very deep in my Pinterest boards right now, thinking about decorating. And like, I'm kind of stuck on a pink dining room. And I just bought an 8-foot bright red dining room table for it. So I'm like deep diving on autism, changing up my business, deep in shamanic studies and home decorations. The next question is, do I have any enemies? And I found this to be so funny. I'm like, I don't think so, but like it's very rare that I dislike people. And that actually has led me to having enemies because I tend to be very trusting, like very, very trusting of people. And too nice. I like everyone immediately. It's really rare that I don't like someone. And I'm pretty tenderhearted. And what's been really upsetting is learning that not all people can be trusted and not all people are good for me. And so over time, I've developed really strong boundaries and because I just don't have capacity. I don't have the time and energy to be close with everyone. just like everybody, and also that some people who I think are beautiful people maybe aren't good for me. So I have strong boundaries, and then folks can interpret that however they wish. Maybe they feel I'm an enemy. But I do have also strong boundaries with people who've abused me. I don't consider them enemies, but like I don't talk to them. So those are some of the like short questions. The next ones get a little bit more deep, and I'm going to just categorize them. So we started with fun questions. Now we're going to move into some personal healing questions. This person asks, how do you hold space for yourself when grieving and hold space and show up in service for others? And I love this question because so many of the folks I know who do care work are so burnt out right now. A lot of the coaches and trauma-informed coaches, therapists I know, social workers, like are so burnt out and so exhausted, especially from the last couple years in the pandemic and with so much social unrest. So it's given me a lot of time to practice this, because a lot of people are quitting those roles because they're emotionally fatigued. So I think being able to hold space for my own grief allows me to be an even better coach. So for me, taking time to grieve, log off of social media, removing all non-essential commitments, that's really key for me. Like I'm at an all-time low when it comes to keeping in contact with people. Like truly, it takes me weeks to respond to people via text sometimes. And I've really pulled back in responding to direct messages because I want to serve my clients well. And to do that, I can't be chatting on the internet all day long. So like periods of low capacity, like when I'm grieving, for me are usually a reset. They allow me to let go of what I said yes to out of obligation or maybe even desire, but are not in my deepest alignment. And I also go to therapy twice a month. I have gone to therapy twice a month with the same therapist, at least for the last 3.5 years. And I was going to therapy before that as well. And during the pandemic, I was seeing a therapist more than twice a month. I also receive body work. I hire skilled coaches when I'm navigating like tricky terrain and going through a big transition. So like in my breakup earlier this year, I was not only going to therapy and receiving body work, but I was also working with Elizabeth D'Alto for a 90-day period because I knew I needed extra support through that transition. So hiring that level of support offers me a space for me to process and integrate and keep me accountable to what I say I will do. And that really supports me. Like I don't just hold space for myself when grieving. I have people hold space for me when I'm grieving, and then also hold space for myself. So my tea practice has been a really big supporter of that, like time alone just to be with my feelings. The next question, how to be confident but have humility. I love this question. And I want to like first say that we have to really take back the idea that like how other people perceive our confidence or our humility that means nothing about what's actually going on for us. So to me, humility and confidence both come from a secure place of self-worth. Where we are egotistic, we're usually going to find shame and fear. And that's why narcissism has a shame core. It is actually masked by grandiosity. People who are narcissistic and are grandiose and appear confident, there's actually a shame core. There's not a secure sense of confidence in their own self-worth. Humility, the word humility, the root word of that is humus, or look, it looks like hummus when it's spelled, but it's like the dirt, it's the soil. And to me, how I interpret that is knowing our rightful place amongst all things. Like to dirt we begin, to dirt we return. That feels like right place, right size. So to be humble is to have an accurate understanding of who we are, not over or underestimating our importance. Whereas like when we're over or underestimating our importance, we're not in contact with the truth. We're really in a distorted sense of reality. So right-sizedness, taking up all of our space, but not more than that. And the root word of confidence, and I don't know that I'm saying this correctly, but is fidere or fid, F-I-D. And that really means to trust. So my interpretation of that is to be secure in our knowing of something or to have faith in it. So in my opinion, true confidence is coupled with humility because we are secure in our sense of self-worth. We can trust in our sense of self-worth. And we do that by getting honest about our fear and our shame, because everyone has fear and shame. If you have fear or shame, you're not a narcissist. Everyone has that. Someone who presents as a narcissist is often due to many factors, predisposition, but also like a lot of early trauma where there's deep insecurity and attachment, deep insecurity and belonging that leads someone to implode into shame. And so we deal with our fear and our shame, no matter how much we have, by leaning into healing. And that can look like going to therapy, using Al-Anon, coaching, or even a mentor who's able to clearly mirror back who we are to us. So I hope that answers the question. I really think that a secure sense of self leads to confidence and humility at the same time. The next question asks, how to know if you are overly dependent on your support system? Having a support system that is strong is so important in our hyper-individualized culture. And I want to just name that there are many reasons why someone would be actually dependent on their support system. And that includes like especially early motherhood, but motherhood in general or parenthood and birthing bodied people like that. Someone who has just given birth is dependent on support. Like truly the reason why so many people experience so much hardship during that time, I think, is due to a lack of those support systems being built into our culture. So other reasons people might be dependent, like maybe they're a college student, or they're a child, or maybe they're disabled in some way, or unable to work for a period of time. And all of those things are very different than codependency, right? Like those things are where like ways that we need to be interconnected, that we need to lean on our support systems. So the difference between codependency and a healthy reliance on people during a time of need is usually found if we are overly attached to the choices of other people, and if other people are overly attached to our choices, which is, of course, enmeshment. So if we're leaning into enmeshment, then there's probably some dependence going on. So if the culture of your support network has a disregard for boundaries, if there's obligation, if there's expectation included in giving, if there's a stifling of self-expression where you can't be your full self, if there's a need for conformity and sameness in order to belong, guilt or shame, and where the emotional worlds of other people are overly permeable, that's a sign of enmeshment. So that's not the same thing as being, you know, dependent on your support system. Enmeshment is where I think it becomes dangerous. So another great sign of this overdependence is shame and lack of self-trust, because enmeshed cultures, family cultures, societal cultures, they embed shame and lack of self-trust as a way to keep us dependent on that unhealthy system of being. So this isn't to say you have to cut ties or walk away from people or go no contact. I'm not saying that at all. But some things you might ask yourself: what would it look like to remain connected to your support network, but also come into your full maturity as an adult, right? So enmeshed cultures do not want people to be individuated into their sovereignty as a fully mature adult. Fully mature adults still depend on their support network, but they also have a secure sense of self. So another question you might ask is, what is hindering my full bloom? Or where might responsibility for myself allow for more connection? I'm going to get to this a little bit later, but I do believe being sovereign in ourselves allows for more connection. And it is, being sovereign is not the same thing as being hyper-individuated or hyper-individual in our culture. So I hope that answers some of those curiosities and sparks some more for you. So the next question is, how do you deal with narcissistic people? Wow, this is a huge question. So I just want to name that I've done some really great episodes on codependency and people pleasing for you to circle back to, because I think they're really supportive in general with boundaries, but also with narcissistic people. And so episode 92 and episode 88. We have an episode with Terry Cole. And then, so episode 92, I did a solo episode on codependency and people pleasing. Episode 88 is with boundary boss expert Terry Cole. And episode 87 is with Louise Mojica. And those are really great places for you to begin to dive into some experts on the topic. But I want to share some things I wish I had known earlier, because I've had my fair share of being in relationships with folks who are narcissistic, and as many people have. And I was raised by someone who I consider to be a narcissist. And so a lot of my adult life has been untethering from that, which is why so much of my work is around sovereignty, because I did not know how to be myself being raised by a narcissist. So first of all, I want to say not every selfish person is a narcissist, and not every narcissist is a malignant narcissist. So about 6% of people are narcissists statistically, But that doesn't mean that every person who is a narcissist is a vindictive, malignant person. So of course we need to be mindful of narcissistic behavior, but just know that like, just because someone has narcissistic qualities does not mean that they're like out to get you. Some narcissists are like that, but not all. So narcissists look out for specific personalities, because certain people are more susceptible to narcissistic abuse. And these people, according to the research I've done, include people who are autistic, people who have a high ACE score or high early childhood developmental traumas, and people who are codependent, people who often have personality disorders that mirror codependency as well. And these people are common victims of narcissists because they're vulnerable. And that doesn't mean that narcissists can't, you know, do the shit they do with all kinds of people. But if you fall into any of those categories, you might want to talk to a therapist about ways to protect yourself and to heal, because they just leave you extra vulnerable to being victimized. So another thing I wanted to mention is that cluster B personalities, which includes but is not limited to narcissism, cannot be reasoned with because it is a personality disorder. And so every selfish person is not a narcissist, but someone who actually has the clinical diagnosis for narcissism or could, they have a personality disorder. So these people cannot be reasoned with. A mistake I made was like, if I could just set boundaries in a better way, if I could just manipulate my own communication in a certain way, that this person would finally see what they were doing and stop abusing me. But this person might have had a personality disorder, and maybe they, for whatever reason, aren't capable. And I learned that not trying to change this person by doing things differently myself, like I was taking so much responsibility, it really helped me to detach from the behaviors and not take them personally. Like, someone truly with narcissism has a personality disorder, and nothing I do to change myself is going to change this person, right? So you might want to learn the signs and tactics that narcissists use. We've all heard of gaslighting. We know what that is. But what really supported me was DARVO, D-A-R-V-O, which stands for Defend and Reverse the Victim Order. Something you might notice if you've been in a relationship with a narcissist is you're going to go to them and be like, hey, you did this thing and it really hurt my feelings and I want to talk to you about it. And somehow at the end of that conversation, you are apologizing. And we've never addressed the thing that they did. We've never addressed your hurt feelings because this person has defended and reversed the victim order. And that's an abuse tactic. It doesn't mean everyone who uses it is a narcissist, but it is something to watch out for. And whenever you are in a relationship with someone and you're starting to feel confused and low self-worth, those are really good signs that you could learn to spot some of these behaviors and be better equipped not to take them personally and redirect your energy. So something else that helped me was knowing that I cannot understand these behaviors because I do not have a personality disorder. So spending my life trying to understand again and change any of this is a waste of my time. The best thing I can do is set boundaries. And I don't mean boundaries as in communicate to the other person how to be, because that's often what we do, right? When we're setting boundaries, it's like, I'm going to set boundaries and this person won't listen to my boundaries. But your boundaries are what you do. This is what I teach in all of my programs, especially Rising Sovereign, is like, your boundaries are about what you do. And we cannot manipulate anyone's behavior through setting boundaries. We can ask people to not call us at certain times, or we can ask people not to come over unannounced, but we cannot force anyone to behave in the way that we want to. So the consequences of the boundaries are, we don't answer the phone, we don't open the door, we don't engage in the ways that are toxic for us anymore. So your commitment to your own boundaries is key if you're in a relationship with someone that has some narcissistic traits, or just maybe has some, as James Olivia Chu Hillman says, relational fuckery, which I think is a wonderful destigmatized way to talk about some of these behaviors. So, and just last thing I want to say is just remember that confusion is the name of the game with narcissism. So find a mentor, a guide, a coach, a therapist who knows you and can mirror back your truth, so that they can support you in healing these wounds of narcissistic abuse. So I hope that that's helpful. The next question that was sent in was about jealousy. And this person says, what do I do when I'm jealous of someone and feel like I cannot stand them? I struggle following them, struggle seeing them feel joy and do the things that I want to do. I love their work, but I want them to fail miserably. So when I read this, oh, I just got such a pit in my stomach and I felt really sad, to be honest. if honestly, to me, this is a sign that a lot of deeper healing needs to happen. If the jealousy you're experiencing is causing this much inner distress, some things I would immediately do is unfollow these people, even if you like them, because clearly it's creating a dynamic that is not working for you. So unfollow these people and then remove yourself potentially from social media if social media is a big activator of this. So like get off social media, get away from the trigger of this, and then of course, that's not going to solve the problem. So then seek support from a skilled therapist to see where this pain is originating. Something that I know to be true is that whenever we have trauma or our nervous system doesn't have capacity for joy or capacity for visibility or for success, it can be really activating to our system to see someone have something we want or do something that our system actually feels is terrifying. And so it would be a really wise thing to do to seek out a skilled somatic-based therapist that can support you in not just digesting and mobilizing some of this jealousy and the feelings of wanting someone else to fail. Like those are some really dense, difficult feelings. But a lot of that could be due to lack of capacity for joy, lack of capacity for showing up for yourself. And I think it would be a really good idea to see someone who could help you move some of that energy and then expand your capacity, because it sounds like you actually really like this person, like their work, but it's overcoupled with a lot of other stuff going on. So that's what I would do. Seek therapy, specifically a somatic type of therapy and trauma-informed therapy. So this next person asks, what supported you in embodying radical acceptance? I would love to hear if there was one aha moment or something you gradually integrated. And my answer is it's been a journey. I've been doing healing work for over 10 years. And before that, I was in college and my degree was communication and psychology, so healing work. I've been very interested in this for a long time and have been seeking for even longer than that. So in many ways, I feel like radical acceptance happened over 10 years, and then there were moments where it felt like it happened all at once. So I really see each therapy and coaching session, each energy work session, each choice of integrity, like getting divorced or coming out or a realignment in my work, that all of these brought me into a deeper place of self-acceptance. And so there have been many aha moments that felt like something just like clicked in, along with lots and lots of very boring moments of just living my life. And in living my life, I've realized how much like the boring stuff, the just living, it's so healing. And together that has had a domino effect. I really see, as I look back on the last 10 years, I mean, I've spent so much money, like so much money trying to fix these things that I felt were broken. And then also things that were actually not working. And I've realized like none of that was for loss, because it has all led to feeling so much more embodied. And I really think the last 3 years are the years that I feel like the physical embodied difference. There was a lot I knew intellectually, a lot of really healthy choices I was making for my health before that. But the felt sense of it, like I thought I was doing well before, but I can feel the well-being and the result of all of that. I hate to say work, because healing isn't always work, but that's a really popular term also. So do the work. Like I can feel the result, like the benefit of a devotion to my own healing practice and being well. So I would say even more than calling it a healing practice, like I'm really devoted to living my liberation and feeling well. And there have been many moments of ahas and many moments of boring shit that has made that happen. So that's all for the personal life questions, like the personal healing specific questions. And now we're going to move on to my ex-husband and my divorce. There were so many questions about this. And I'm not surprised, because the pandemic really revealed a lot of marriage shit for people. And a lot of people are contemplating their relationships right now. So this person asks, was the split with my husband mostly amicable? And do we talk at all? So I wouldn't say it was totally amicable. Like he really wanted to work it out and tried to present that we could have an open relationship. But I'm not polyamorous, and that didn't work for me. That kind of felt like a way for him to like be with two women. And yeah, it just was like, I understand where he was coming from, like wanting to save the marriage, not wanting to get divorced, like the potential of a threesome. But I was just like, that's going to be a no for me. So coming out was like an easy way to say that we closed the relationship. But truthfully, it wasn't the only reason for my divorce. I had been expressing unhappiness in the marriage for a couple years. We got married really young. And so we just grew into really different people with different desires for our lives. Like we worked really well together. We weren't a couple that fought a lot. We had like a good life, but it wasn't like necessarily fulfilling. I didn't feel like we were connecting in the ways that I wanted to connect. So like things were good, but something was wrong, you know? So when I realized I was queer, he, you know, did his best to understand, but he came from a Christian background and really hadn't devoted himself to understanding the impact of the patriarchy, power dynamics, homophobia, and my coming out, I saw at the time for him a lot of internalized homophobia and patriarchy that were the deeper issues in the marriage, because all of that Christian programming were very much embedded into me making more money than him and that being a problem and all of those sorts of like weird Christian stuff. And so as that was revealed during me coming out, I knew that I could not continue exploring my own fullness inside that relational container. Some folks are able to come out and stay married and it's wonderful, like stay married to their husbands, but that was just not gonna work for me. So we did end on good terms and we do talk every now and then, but we're not very close. Like I feel like I love him like a brother, like someone that like it'd be nice to run into him or have coffee with him sometime. I did recently find out he has a new partner and he's very happy with her, which made me feel so good inside. And yeah, Phil is a genuinely like he's a very good person. And I do still have a deep brotherly love, but we're not really, really close in the way that I maybe thought that we would be. We're not, but I'm happy with the way it is. So the next person asks about my last name change. Why did I choose it? How did I choose it? The response of family. So for those of you who don't know, Morrigan is a chosen name. My maiden name was Barrow. It's very English. Madison Barrow was the name I grew up with. And funny fact, I have a sister named Madeline Barrow, and we both went by Maddie Barrow growing up. So very weird. I'll have to get into like my whole family system in order to like really reveal what that's about. But basically, the way I chose this name was I was on a retreat for a program I was in, like a group coaching program. And my friend Geraldine told me that she had chosen her own name. And it was the first time I'd ever heard of a woman doing that, like really being like, I just made it up. I was like, you can do that. The group was kind of exploring mythology and archetypes. And long story short, we got on the topic of the Morrigan, who is the Celtic goddess of war and sovereignty. And Madison actually means son of a warrior. And so at the time, I was really like, feeling the need for protection and sovereignty. And that name Morrigan just like really stood out to me. And so I started just telling friends I was thinking about it and people responded with like, that's weird. But eventually it just felt really good. And within 6 months, I just like did it. And so my dad actually struggled with it the most, which is funny because he did not mind me taking my ex-husband's name. But he has a lot of questions about why I didn't take his last name again. So it cost about $500 in total between like the lawyer and everything. And honestly, I hated the legal process. Like I don't like all of my like credit cards and stuff aren't switched over because I just hate paperwork. But legally it is changed. It's my business name. It's my personal name. It's on my driver's license. But gosh, it just, it's a lot of work to change your name. And so I'm like, damn, if you're getting married, like maybe don't change your name. That's just my opinion. Maybe just don't, because it's a lot of work to get it changed back to anything. So those are my thoughts. This next question is, how long did it take you to heal from your divorce? And have you had any regrets about your divorce? Truthfully, I was not wounded from my divorce. It was the right choice. I never really missed my ex-husband. Like I had grief over hurting him. That was hard, but I didn't feel wounded by the divorce itself. Like by the time I made the choice to get divorced, I had processed a lot of the feelings I had about it. The biggest struggle I had was getting into right relationship because I had jumped right into a relationship with a woman. Like, and that's not, I actually don't have judgment about that choice, but I didn't have time to process my queerness. It was a lot of big change at once. So I was getting divorced. I was like single-ish for the first time in my entire life. And I was out and newly out, and I hadn't processed my own queerness because I didn't know I was queer until I like met the person I was then partnered with. And it took me about a year to stabilize around that. Like it was a really hard thing. And then like the pandemic happened. It was just so much all at once. And so truthfully, I did make some like errors of ignorance through that process. I took some advice from a mentor that I really should not have had as a mentor, someone who very much was manipulative and misguided me. And I was like desperate and looking for advice on how to navigate this. And I was operating from a lot of trauma. Like I outsourced my power to this person. I was really trying to get divorced and come out in this like perfectly right way. And I ended up hurting like everyone involved. So I don't live in a state of regret around it, because alongside these mistakes I made, I was also like really listening to myself. Like there was a part of me that was like really honoring something that I knew. It was just messy. Like it was just messy, and it was the best I could do at the time. But I see things differently now, so I would do things differently now. Wouldn't say I regret it, but yeah, made some mistakes that ended up hurting me and everyone. So how did I know divorce was the right choice? Like I didn't know for sure. I didn't know for sure. And I don't think we can ever know anything like that for sure. I did the best with the information I had, which was I wasn't happy. I had tried everything to like fix the marriage. I was going to therapy. I was taking responsibility. I was having honest conversations. But I knew I didn't want kids with my ex-husband. I didn't want to buy a house with him. Like my body was like a no for that. And that was really obvious. I was realizing I was queer. I knew I didn't want to hurt him, but I knew I was lying to myself. And so I'm like, my body is just so obvious. Like I had hives that put me in the hospital the moment I met my ex-girlfriend. Like my body was just like, get the fuck out of this marriage. Like there was something that I was denying about myself, and the hives and all of my food allergies completely went away after I left my ex-husband. So my body led me out, and I wasn't certain. I rarely feel certain about anything, but I was listening to like that guidance. So the next question is about, did I come out with my partner or did I come out before we were together? And I think this is talking about my relationship with my ex-girlfriend. Like, did I come out with her? So I was married when I realized I was queer by falling for a friend. I hated how this happened, to be honest. I hated because I really did not consider myself someone that would ever fall for someone while I was married. I had really strong boundaries around like flirting with people or anything like that, but I didn't know I was queer. And I basically like fell in love with a person before I realized that I was queer. Like it was like a couple months of like really deep friendship. And I was like, oh shit, I'm in love with this woman. And I didn't know to have boundaries with her because like in that way, I wasn't really sure what was happening. And I also had mentors that were like, you're not queer. You're just experiencing a regulated nervous system for the first time. And that's why you feel so good to be around this person. Like I was just so confused, and I hated that that's how it happened. Like I was very honest with my ex-husband whenever I realized I had feelings for her, but it was messy. And so like long story short, I like told my ex-husband was attracted to her. And then within 2 weeks, I was like, I want a divorce and I want to separate and I want to start dating her. And that's what I did. So by the time I was out publicly, I was already with her and I was already separated from my husband and like getting divorced, which that process just takes a while. So it absolutely shattered like a part of me. It broke my idea of what a good woman was, what a good wife was. And I really held myself to that. It was a huge identity death. Yeah, it was an experience of intense grief and regret with the finalization of my divorce. Like I didn't regret getting divorced, but like I regretted how it happened. Like I wish I was at the time, I don't feel this way anymore, but at the time I was like, I wish that I had gotten divorced earlier. I wish I had known I was queer earlier. It just, gosh, that was really hard. It was really hard and a lot to process. So kind of like circling back to the previous question, like I didn't know it was the right choice, but a lot was happening at once and I don't regret it now, but I look back and I'm just like, damn, that was really hard. I was holding a lot and honoring myself and making mistakes all at once because being a human is messy like that. So this person asks that they said they are experiencing intense grief with the finalization of their divorce and yet they know it was the best choice. Any advice? And I would just say, give yourself space and time. space and time. Like, change is just hard, even if you're making the right choice. So there's a Huberman Lab podcast on grief, and he talks about this from a neurobiological lens. And I really found it helpful to understand the biology of grief, even if you're making aligned choices, because it's attachment stuff, it's biological stuff, it's hormones. There's a lot going on whenever change happens and we're distanced from someone we were once close to. So I recommend checking that out. You could just Google Huberman Lab grief and it will absolutely pop up. So this next category of questions is about spirituality. And the first question is very simple. It's just, what is your sign? So I'm a Virgo sun, I'm a Pisces moon, and a Libra rising. So make do with that what you will. The next person says, I'm curious about your current spiritual practices, such as human design and astrology and other pop psychologies that borrow from Eastern traditions. As a former religious person yourself, do you believe your adherence to these New Age beliefs are akin to your time as a Christian, believing without reason? So I do find this question so interesting because it makes an assumption that I like adhere to these New Age beliefs. And I don't think that I do. So I don't consider human design or astrology a part of my spiritual practices. I view my spiritual practices to be things that ground me in my body, in the natural world, and that aid me in ritual and transformation. I would say my spiritual practices, if you know what fourth way spiritual practices are, like my spiritual practices are grounded in that. They're grounded in reality, and they're grounded in like a contemplative practice. I do find like tools like human design and astrology to be helpful in mirroring back to me like what's up with me. Like, I have never done a human design reading or an astrology reading that was like, wow, I didn't know that. Like, they're usually things that tell me things I already intuitively know about me and offer reassurance or something like that. I just like tarot cards or oracle cards. To me, like, they just reveal what's up with me. I don't feel like I rely on them as like a crutch or any sort of believing without reason. I think if something mirrors something to you, there's always something, and like your response to that is something to contemplate. So I take all of these things with a grain of salt. With human design, for example, like, I'm a 4-1 generator in human design. And that made a lot of sense to me whenever I was told that 4-1s are very fixed in the way that they are. They are like that, what some people call like a bonus life, kind of like set in their ways. I'm like, that seems to be true about me. I'm a generator. I respond to things, emotional authority. I'm like, all of that just feels like intuitively how I already live. So I don't feel like I have had to like change anything about the way I'm living, because it just felt like I'm already doing that. So that's kind of how I've used those tools. And to me, they differ from my experience with Christianity in a vast way, because when I was a Christian, so much of what this person says was believing without reason. One, wasn't necessarily believing without reason. It was void of critical analysis, but it was tied up in dogma and tied up in belonging and tied up in all or nothing thinking. And to me, like, now I'm able to engage with all kinds of ideas and spiritual texts and experiences with critical thought and curiosity and self-observation without taking anything on as like the truth. So I'm of the belief that all religions and tools and basically everything can be used to see ourselves, and that most like the big world religions and spiritual practices are all trying to point at the same thing. And that's to rid oneself of self-deception, which is like the ways that we deceive ourselves and project, and to engage with source, like God, source, a higher power, connectedness, and then to know our true self and to be of service. Like, if ultimately, like, all of these like human design and astrology practices don't lead me back to being of service, I don't find them that spiritual. Like, they're like interesting information, but true spiritual practice to me brings me to awe and wonder and self-knowing without self-deception, and then eventually moves me into service. And we can misuse all sorts of tools and spiritual texts without critical thought and believing without reason. I don't think pop spirituality or mainstream religion or I think anything else for that reason could be something we adhere to. I think politically people are religious. I don't think being religious or being dogmatic is being spiritual. So I hope that kind of answers the question. Maybe not. Maybe I've just opened up a rabbit trail. So this next person asks, do you have any resistance to channeling and mediumship because of your religious background? Any advice on how to work through it? So I actually do believe that these things exist. Like, I've had dreams that have come true. I've had like very clear messages come through about something that ends up happening later or ends up being true about someone else, where I'll just know something about someone. And I don't think that that's necessarily special. I think what the like spiritual communities do is they make all these like very human abilities very special, and then we like put them on a pedestal, and then people can misuse their power around them. So like I do believe in these things, but I'm very cautious about listening to anyone who says they practice these things. Like I find like feeling clear in your own truth and having a strong inner guidance and discernment about what's right for you to be key. Like if you're opening yourself up to guidance from a channeled message from a reader, like someone who's reading something for you, like I love Akashic Records readings, but again, like I see them through like what resonates with me, and I don't take them as truth. And I think what happens in the spiritual community a lot is people, they go to human design and astrology and like channeled readings, and they're like, oh, I'm doing the work because I'm aligning myself to these things, but you haven't really like self-contemplated or developed discernment in doing those things. So if you are someone who uses these like modalities of knowing ourselves, which are fine, I would really also encourage you to do some self-discernment work and feeling like, how do you know what you know to be true for you? That is really important. This next person asks, do I believe in angel numbers? What do they mean if you see them frequently? Like, believe is such an interesting word. I don't know that I believe in angel numbers like the way that some people do, but whenever I see them, I do enjoy the feeling of like getting a wink from the universe. Like if it makes me happy, great. Personally, a lot of the beliefs, I talk about this in Awaken Her Soul, but I choose to believe that the universe is working for me. Not everyone wants to believe that. That's fine. But for me, that belief is affirmed by like, if I see a butterfly and I'm like, wow, that is so beautiful. It doesn't mean that that butterfly exists for me, right? Like I know with critical thought, it doesn't mean that it exists for me. And I'm like so grateful for the opportunity to see it, that it reminds me of like being interconnected. It reminds me of divine order. And I feel like angel numbers are the same for me. They just like reaffirm the belief that the world is happening for my benefit. And that belief supports me. And not everyone agrees, but I like it. So the next question is, did you have any false starts with leaving religion, ending your marriage, or going no contact with family? When were you able to know how to make a clean break? So honestly, I'm someone who's very slow to making decisions. Like it takes me a long time to make a clean break, but once I'm there, I'm there. Like in general with my relationships, like I've usually grieved the relationship before I leave it. Like I've usually done a lot of work to process a decision like that before I make it. I don't like just to uproot my life for no reason, although I have done it. So once I make a decision, I've usually processed it for a long time. This person asks, in the spirit of free love, what do you find to be the most important thing when it comes to ordering different relationships? And this person hashtags poly. I am not poly. I will just state that. Like I'm not poly, but I do cherish my chosen family and friendships. And so I prioritize, I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, the inner sanctuary, like my sacred temple that I teach in the ceremony that we do in January. And based on my own like sacred temple method, I outline people who are in the innermost part of my relational temple as people I can be my most self around, people who I can be my most fully expressed, where I feel the least judged, and who my body feels softest around. So for me, as someone who is monogamous, that's going to be like my intimate partner, right? It's like God, me, then my intimate partner, and then my dearest friends. And it kind of expands out from that. And I live a very social life. Like I see friends a couple times a week. And like my chosen family is a chosen family. Like we really spend a lot of time together. So yeah, I'm not poly, but I do think that I have a very strong support system and kind of organize my relationships based on the way I feel around people. So this next category is some questions about ending my last partnership with a woman. So some of you know, I came out of my marriage. I got into a partnership. I was with that person for about 2.5 years, and we broke up in February of this year, of 2022. This someone asks, what made you finally decide to leave that relationship? And so during that entire relationship, I was really working on attachment-based, somatic-based trauma therapy. I'm someone who had a very anxious, leaning, disorganized attachment before I got into that relationship. And that relationship revealed a lot to me about family dynamics that were still left unhealed for me, and attachment woundings. Because as I got more and more well through attachment work, the relationship like disintegrated. It just stopped working. And I really think that if the pandemic hadn't happened, we wouldn't have stayed together for so long because we were like quarantined together. And I think that happened to a lot of people, like they were quarantined with a partner. And I don't think the pandemic is the reason it didn't work. I think that the pandemic is the reason it worked for so long. It was good when it was good. And then I outgrew and healed from a lot of the relational dynamics that were present in my entire life up until then. And I realized also that this person and I had a lot of shared interests. I was like, finally, someone who's into spirituality. And they were into yoga and they were into wellness. And like, I loved that. Those were things my ex-partner was not into. But sharing interests is not the same thing as sharing values and fundamental needs and fundamental desires for partnership. And we were extremely mixed match when it came to our needs, values, and desires. And so between that and realizing I was engaging, to stay would mean I would have to keep engaging in an old dynamic that was, I had outgrown. It just wasn't working. And I had a couples therapist with this person that was very validating in my choice. And Elizabeth D'Alto, who I was working with, was also very validating in my choice. And I am the healthiest I've ever been since leaving that relationship. So this next person asks, how's the healing been after the breakup? And thankfully, I was incredibly well supported through the end of the relationship and with the couples therapist and with my personal one-on-one therapist. And so like leaving the relationship felt like really getting to feel myself for the first time, like outside of relationship and outside of a lot of the dynamics that weren't working. So I have been healing from things post-relationship that I didn't expect at all. I grieved the loss of the relationship while inside of it. And the hardest things have been understanding how deep my family dynamic has gone in my relational patterns and really how fried my nervous system was in that relationship. Like I have been so tired in the last 6 months. My capacity is so low because I'm finally like processing just how on I had to be in a way that wasn't good for me. That's what's up with that. So I'm going to move into some other questions. There are the questions about life philosophy and queerness coming up. So if you are still here and still listening, I want to move on to some other things. So a person just asked this random question. They just moved to Springfield, which is where I live, and they say, tell me the cool spots. So welcome, first of all. I think Springfield, Missouri is one of the most sacred little gyms in the entire country. It is affordable to live here. Great place for building a business. Great place for community. I love it here. Diversity and culturally lacking. That sucks. So hopefully you love to travel like I do and you can experience those things. But the things I love the Roundtree neighborhood. It's where I've been living. I'm moving away from the Roundtree neighborhood with my new house, but I love living in this neighborhood. Everyone takes good care of their yard, so everything's so cute and so beautiful. So if you love a good walk and love to get like a coffee, you get coffee from Cherry Picker, which is a really cute coffee shop that I love, and get to take a walk around the neighborhood. Great local food in Roundtree. The Golden Girl Rum Club is my favorite pizza in town. If you're someone who likes cocktails, you would like it for that reason too, but the pizza is honestly so good. For a work day, I love the Coffee Ethic. I love the Nature Center, Zaika Indian food. I have boba tea from Society a lot. Corner 21 is the best Chinese food in all of Springfield, and we have a lot of Chinese food. And Jade's classes at the studio are wonderful. And if you're into indie films, you're going to want to check out Moxie Theater. So for those of you who aren't in Springfield, if you ever come through town, that's what I recommend. So some life philosophy questions. It's really just like two really juicy questions. So this person asks, at what point do teachings around sovereignty and personal power just equal manifesting the life you want and becoming another version of bootstrapping and ignoring the realities of capitalism? So wow. Potent question. Glad you asked. So my concept of sovereignty and personal power is that they are innate, meaning your sovereignty and your power are innate. And I believe systems of oppression like skin color supremacy and toxic capitalism thrive on people being stripped of their personal power and stripped of their sovereignty. So sovereignty, when represented by a healthy system, will look like a mature and interconnected adult who's able to take responsibility for their life, their land, and their community. And it's not devoid of interconnectedness. In fact, I believe that we can't really belong together unless we belong to ourselves. Because as I talked about earlier, it looks like enmeshment. And we can't have sovereign choice, which is to not be in trauma. Like trauma equals lack of choice. Not being well and being in our sovereignty equals we have choice. And so to really be able to choose people and to choose from our conscious mind requires that we are in our personal sovereignty. So bootstrapping, in my opinion, is an inverse relationship to sovereignty, one where we must disassociate from our bodies. So if we are bootstrapping, we are not feeling ourselves. We are not feeling what we're doing. We're forcing our bodies to do things by violating ourselves and sometimes violating other people. So bootstrapping and sovereignty, I'm like, they are not the same thing. Hyper-individuation, hyper-individualized culture, bootstrapping culture, it doesn't consider personal sovereignty in the way that I view it, because it means we belong together by belonging to ourselves. And the term holarchy really brought this home for me. It's a term I learned from Ken Wilber, who teaches on spiral dynamics, which is something I so nerd out on. It's basically a way that we have evolved our consciousness through values-based ways of living. So if you're curious about Ken Wilber and spiral dynamics, you can just do a Google search, spiral dynamics, and you'll see some of the basic diagrams. But whenever he says holarchy, what he means is that we must be able to be self-referencing and other-oriented, both. We need both. His theory describes that as we evolve along our developmental process as individuals and as cultures and society, he described it as like going from me focus to we focus. And doing that in unison creates a greater whole, and one cannot exist without the other. Developmentally, like as individual people, we start off completely connected, not knowing we are a self in the womb. And we must go through the individuation process to realize we're not the mother in order to reach maturity. And so that isn't to say we remain self-focused. Actually, like children are self-focused. Individuated adults are not self-focused. They just have a self. So only in having a self can we choose from our sovereignty to relate to other people. And you won't find that as an act of choice in bootstrapping or ignoring realities. I know I just said a lot of information, but it is my true opinion that like we cannot have sovereign choice and bootstrapping together. They don't go together. This person says, I've been in therapy and working on myself for years, and I'm now training to become a psychotherapist. Congratulations. They said, I'd like to find a partner who's in the same place as I am on my healing journey. Slim picking so far. Any advice? So yeah, congrats on becoming a psychotherapist. And I totally hear you on finding someone with a similar developmental place as you. And my biggest piece of advice is to raise your standards and like actually raise them. So like don't raise them and then like go on a bunch of dates with people you know don't have those standards. Like get clear on them, write down your values, write down the traits you want this person to have, write down what you're no longer willing to tolerate, put it on an altar, set it on fucking fire, and then watch. Like you will be surprised at how often people will rise to meet you once you've decided. So just decide, like actually decide. And then don't focus on the people who can't meet you there. Give your attention only to the people who can. So I'm going to share some questions about queerness now. So the next question reads, what in your experience are the differences in being in a romantic relationship with a woman versus a man? Positives, challenges, what was it like to fall in love with a woman? As someone who prefers women as an orientation, it's kind of hard to be completely unbiased because this isn't going, like my experience is not going to be the same as other people who are queer, other people with different sexual orientations, because all people are different. And I do think that the answer to this depends on your orientation. And I really do think that I learned the hard way that women are not necessarily free of toxic masculinity. No matter what gender someone has, if they haven't done any work to deconstruct internalized heteronormativity and internalized patriarchy, we can have tendencies towards toxicity in those areas. So dating someone new, right now I'm dating someone new, it's really clear to me that there are also really healthy ways of relating that I didn't experience in the past and that it's not necessarily gendered. So I am dating a woman right now. I was married to a man for 7 years. We were together for 9. My first relelationship with a woman was 2.5 years, and then I'm in a new relationship. So very excited. Now I don't think the internet knows that yet. But yeah, I'm dating someone new and she's a woman and it's going really wonderfully. And it's really different than my last relationship. So just know that as I share this list of positives, it's different with each person. So positives I've experienced being with a woman. I think women are more emotionally attuned in general, so that's great. I think women have softer skin, better, more exploratory and fun sex. Again, that probably has to do with my orientation, but it feels safer for me and more fun. I think there are less relational roles, stereotypes, and gender binaries in a queer relationship, more creativity in the relationship, less expectation of how I'm supposed to be as a woman myself. I have healed my own body image and my own internalized femme hatred and hatred of the female body, like hatred and internalized ideas that vulvas are gross or bodies are disgusting. Like I don't believe that anymore. And it's really helped me, like, help my relationship to myself, not just my relationship with other people I've dated. So less internalized patriarchal norms and more self-explorations. But the challenges I experienced with women is that when things got bad, they were much worse. Like my ex-husband and I, again, these are just the couple relationships I've been in, but we did not fight or argue in the same way that I did with my ex-partner. My relationship with women, I feel like because the emotional attunement, there can be more emotional manipulation, more confusion. And I found that relationship to be much more like emotionally debilitating than my relationship with my ex-husband ever was. I also think there can be internalized queer shame and trauma in the queer community, because a lot of times there are not resources for queer folks to be in, like, especially where I live, engaging in conversations around their queerness with therapists who understand or who are affirming. And I think a lot of folks in the queer community have a lot of trauma from homophobia and growing up in homophobic churches, families. So also challenges I experienced were friends asking inappropriate questions about sex, strangers giving dirty looks, and then also personally being naive to subtle power dynamics that were not as obvious as man and woman. I think power dynamics show up in a number of ways, and I wasn't really looking for power dynamics because I just thought, oh, if I'm with a woman, everything will be better. And again, that isn't necessarily true. But falling in love with my first girlfriend, it was like a kind of like an overwhelming experience because I felt like it was happening to me. Before I met her, I didn't know I was queer. And so it was an awakening. And that felt really overwhelming. I didn't necessarily feel safe in my body around my own queerness yet. I felt nervous. I felt awkward. Kind of felt like having your first sexual experiences as a teenager, right? You're just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm nervous. But falling in love again has been much less heightened. And I think I've mentioned earlier that I've done a lot of attachment healing and a lot of nervous system healing in the last couple years. And I think that this new relational template of the person I'm dating now, it's so different due to, one, having known this person for a long time. We've been friends for about 8 years. So that level of safety feels much different. I also already knew I was queer. I wasn't having an awakening or getting divorced at the same time. And having like a more, basically more regulation and more security in my attachments means that this relationship feels very different and less heightened getting into it. Whereas my last relationship, I see how there were unresolved trauma bonds due to having, I didn't have the same level of awareness or healing around my attachments and my nervous system at the time. So no self-judgment for that version of myself. It's just where I was at and it's what I had. So I feel much more in my power now. And falling in love is feeling like being in my power and getting like falling more in love over time as opposed to this really intense, overwhelming experience in the beginning. So I feel like the sovereign adult choosing this, and it feels sweet and sparkly and safe and like really gentle expansion. Yeah, that's my experience so far with being with women versus being with men. And I just want to remind you that it depends because everyone is different. No matter their gender, everyone's different. So this person says they're a closeted bisexual in a straight passing monogamous marriage, and they're only out to their spouse and some online friends and have no experience being with women, but they're experiencing a longing. How do I navigate this? And I just want to say, without knowing you personally and all the nuances of your marriage, I'm going to refrain from like templated advice about what you should do. If we were in a session, here's what I would be curious about. Is your partner secure with your bisexuality? 2, have you and your partner discussed ways you can feel sexually expressed that honor your monogamous marriage? And 3, what specifically are you desiring to experience? Is it exploration, getting to know a part of yourself? Or are you wanting to have a specific experience with women? Or is this about feeling ownership around your identity as a queer person or as a bisexual person or something different? So I would get really curious about what is it that you're longing for specifically, and are there ways to experience that and really own your bisexuality while inside your marriage? Because it sounds like that's really important to you. So this next person says, I'm planning on coming out to my mom in the next couple weeks via letter. She's not affirming. What types of care or aftercare would you recommend surrounding that? So first of all, congratulations. I know that this is a really big deal, and I'm really sorry that your family is not affirming. I would, first of all, expect nothing. Like, expect nothing from them. Expect what you expect, right? Like, if they're not affirming, like, expect them to not be affirming and just know that they're not going to be. That way you're not expecting maybe a change of heart and then are disappointed. And if that change of heart happens, amazing. But if you kind of just go into it expecting nothing, you're going to feel better equipped, I think. So 2, talk to a friend or book a therapy appointment before and after the conversation. So like kind of bookend the support that you have. So if you have a coach, talk to your coach before and after. If you have a therapist, do like 2 sessions closer together before and after, or talk to a friend and be planning on calling the friend after you share. So 3, gift yourself some loving experience such as a massage or a cozy day at home watching Disney movies, or swaddle yourself up in a really soft robe. Just like really give yourself the experience of being swaddled, like really held and touched and cared for. 4, I would say ask your friends who are supportive to give you validation in support in the days that follow. And also I would say kind of create a game plan on what you want to do depending on this person's response. So if they send you a text message, if they call you, like, what do you want the boundaries around the way that you engage with this person going forward to be if they are not affirming? So you get to decide that, and then you get to engage with this person in ways that feel really good for you. Along with this question, the next person asks, how did your family react to your coming out? Honestly, with a lot of my family, I like never really came out to most of them. I really just lived my life and let them figure it out on their own. I posted, I think, on social media once, and like, I guess I came out by like being in pictures with a woman and by being like, hey, I got divorced, I'm dating a woman, but I wasn't ever telling them like, these are my identities. My cousins and siblings were all very chill and didn't seem to have much of a reaction outside of curiosity. And, you know, at the time I was getting divorced, so people had care for my well-being. And then a lot of like people actually came out to me whenever I came out, which was super fun to experience. My dad is not affirming, but is very kind. So I will just say my dad does not think it's okay to be queer, but he is very good to me still. And then my mom and my stepdad were both just very perplexed. And I went no contact with them shortly after I came out, but it wasn't because I came out that we went no contact. That had to do with other relational dynamics that had nothing to do with being queer. So the final question I'm answering today is, what is my perspective on polyamory? And so I believe polyamory to be an orientation. I think some people are poly, just in the same way some people are queer. And that is not my orientation. I do not feel oriented towards polyamory. So I don't think it's for everyone, but I think it's very healthy and correct for some people. And I think there are some amazing books and resources out there, PolySecure being, I think, the most talked about resource that I've heard. And then I also did a podcast episode with Evian Whitney, who shared about their experience being in a polyamorous relationship, if you're curious to hear someone who knows much more about it than I do. That's all for today, everyone. I am just so grateful you listened to like an hour and 12 minutes of this conversation. Next week, I'm going to be sharing some personal questions around my business and my work. So if you're curious specifically to hear what I have to say around my business, the behind the scenes, the teen stuff, I would love to share that with you next week. But for now, just a reminder that next week I am again hosting that Vision Cast workshop on the 14th of September at 11 a.m. Central Time, and would love to have you there live. I'll be doing a Q&A at the end around business. So if you can't catch the podcast, come to the live Vision Cast. I'll do some some Q&A there as well. And it's going to be a really good time, incredibly supportive. So you can go to madisonmorrigan.com/visioncast, like casting a spell for your vision, and register. It's free to sign up. You can make a donation if you really enjoy the experience, and the replay is available for 7 days. So thank you so much for indulging with me in this fun Q&A. I had a really good time, and hopefully in the new year, we'll be doing more episodes just like this. All right, everybody. Well, in the meantime, I'll be seeing you in email and on social media. Talk to you soon. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to Everything Belongs. I am so grateful knowing the amount of input and content there is available that you take the time to listen to this show and so value your attention and the fact that you choose to keep tuning in. If you're curious about today's guest, you can go to madisonmorrigan.com/podcast to get all of the show notes and all the links to their website. If you are receiving heaps of value from this podcast and want to continue to support the team that makes it possible or just simply say thank you, consider contributing to our gratitude offering. It is a small way to say thank you and give back to the podcast by creating reciprocity. We have 4 different ways for you to contribute, from $7 a month to $37 a month, or even a one-time thank you contribution. You can choose your level of support from $7 monthly, $17 monthly, $37 monthly, or a one-time contribution. And for those who choose to give on a monthly basis, what you'll get in return is an 8-minute hypnotic induction, which is basically a fancy meditation to support you in anchoring in gratitude as your baseline state. It uses nervous system regulating breath, bilateral stimulation that helps you reprogram old stories, binaural beats for calming your mind, gentle hypnotic suggestions, and absolutely 0 cheesy count your blessings type lists. Plus, whenever you choose to support on a monthly basis, you get access to my close friends on Instagram. This bonus gift is my way of saying thank you so much for supporting the podcast, where you will join my Instagram close friends and will basically be able to hear my personal rants, photos, daily happenings, and the hilarious memes that I share with my closest friends. This content is created just for fun. It's not marketing material. It's nothing that I create specifically for my business. It is just for fun, and I would love to have you in that inner circle. Basically, I would love to share my weird with you as a way to say thank you for supporting the podcast. Plus, of course, you will receive insider's access to all the discounts I offer, first dibs on new opportunities to work together, and that generous feeling of abundance and reciprocity for contributing to something that you get a lot from. If you're curious about joining the gratitude offering, you can go to madisonmorrigan.com/gratitude-offering. And if you're looking for a free way to say thank you and to contribute your energy to the show, please leave a 5-star review. That is the simplest and easiest way to send your generosity and to send your thanks. And it really helps boost our ratings in iTunes and reach more people who might enjoy it. In the meantime, I would love for you to join me on Instagram, DM me, and let me know your favorite part of this episode. And until next time, remember that curiosity can be a portal to a life where everything belongs.